With extra beard. Got beard mouse?
Some fuzzy logic.
Recording in Los Gatos, California on February 8th, 2016. This is Beard Lovin' from the boys. Los Gatos.
We're all mountain men now.
This is Geek Speak, episode 6 of our 16th season. You're listening to Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geek's affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxler, your host and producer of Geek Speak, and with me in the studio is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Hey, Miles.
How's it going?
Good. Do you have what do I say in the middle of that? Affiliated organization?
You. Geek Speak.
Just Geek Speak.
I can't talk crap about Geek Speak while on Geek Speak.
I guess I should have an or in there, or any of the Geek's affiliated other organizations. Be more clear, right? No, you can't represent Geek Speak, except for when you're on the show.
Hey, I got the business cards, man.
Oh, man. I knew that was a bad idea. How many of those you got left? 7 million?
Oh, yeah.
You have no idea. You got a small box, and I got one of those extra long boxes, plus a small
box.
I got
the long boxes.
Oh, my gosh. We have so many. If you need a business card from one of us, you just let us know. Hey, if you want to ask us questions and comments, you can email us at geeks@geekspeak.org. And that's actually on our business card. It's actually a personal name, I think.
The funny part about it is, if I carried them with me more often, I'd have gotten rid of them. Whenever someone wants a card or I have an impetus to give someone my business card, I never have them with me. And then I stack like 10 of them in my wallet and they just sit there for months.
Molting. Hey, 15 years ago this month was the official launch of the VLC. You know what VLC is?
The Video LAN...
Client.
Okay,
yes,
there we go.
Good. This is a orange coned icon, and it's a video player that works on Windows and Linux and Macintosh, and it plays basically any video file format.
It's a front end to FFmpeg, right?
It is. Well, yeah. But it also has other libraries. It's a whole project of open source development about playing any video. And it really is one of those things, if you're not sure about how to play a video, you get this thing, VLC, and I think you can get it, just search VLC. You'll find it, Video LAN client, and it plays anything. Anyway, yeah. they just did 15 years. They filed their first GPL on the 1st of February 2001, and I've used it. I always have it on my machines. When I was doing media stuff at UCSC, it was one of the recommended. I had everybody install it because when you can't deal with a video file, it's kind of a pain.
Yeah, like a DivX file that's on an old CD. I've tried playing it, and like it worked on QuickTime years ago, and then suddenly. They can't read it. What's going on? Yeah. Fire up VLC. It plays it.
And VLC, of course, also, though it's a little hard to do, you can actually re-encode stuff with VLC. Mm-hmm. So it's not, it's...
And you can screen grab, capture.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely screen capture as well. Anyway, congratulations and happy birthday to VLC. And if you don't know it and want to use it, just find it online. It's easy to find. And in fact, they just released, like they're doing a lot of stuff, and they just released last month a VLC client for Apple TV. So now if you have a new Apple TV, you can get the VLC for that, which I've got to try because I haven't.
But not the old Apple TVs?
The old Apple TVs didn't have a development platform, really. Like there was a few companies that actually could develop for it, but it was a mess. So the new Apple
and
TV.
Not, I don't have an Apple TV, so I don't know. They don't update via iOS version or something? Like
so the old Apple TV was not really iOS-like. It was a thin web client. Thin web client on top of their stack, and they were very specific about how you did things. The new VLC, the new Apple TV, supports a whole framework. They have a thing called TVOS. So it's just like iOS, but slightly different, and has a whole development platform. And if you're an Xcode developer, you can develop for the Apple TV if you have an idea. If you have an idea, let me know.
It's funny, I do.
What's your idea? Give it away.
No, an idea?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I thought you meant an idea, like a developer ID. I actually
do
for,
why?
For Xcode. I thought I was going to use it, and then I tended goats instead.
Okay, are you going to stop paying for that? Because it's like $100 a year.
Yeah, but I mean, my year hasn't run out yet.
Oh, so it's time, man. You should make an Apple TV thing for my TV. Anyway, let's go on. You got a quick warning for people? Make sure they don't do anything stupid?
Yes, we've covered Benson Leung, an engineer at Google who works on the Pixel team. He's been covering USB-C cables and how many manufacturers have been kind of playing fast and loose with the specs and having cables that don't work as well as they should.
This is the new cable that's on the Pixel. It's on a few different devices, but it's the newer connector.
Right. It's USB that it doesn't matter which side you go on. It doesn't have that the quantum superposition of the old USB where you try plugging it in the one way and then you flip it over and try plugging it the other way and go, oh no, it's the other way. And plug it back the first way.
It's not just a quantum superposition. It's also, you could also think about it as fourth dimensional objects, because when you rotate things in fourth dimensional space and you look at their shadow, they rotate like that. So anyway, it depends on which way you're at.
Yeah. So he's been on a one-man crusade on Amazon giving reviews. So the good cables, he goes like, hey, this is totally great and perfect. And the bad ones, he goes, yeah, see, this one should have had this type of resistor. Instead, it has this type and it's not a spec.
He's really breaking them down. That's really cool.
Yeah. And I mean, he talks about here's the point in the spec where they violate it. And so this is not. Well, he bought one this time around. And he plugged it into his Chromebook Pixel and his USB testing equipment. Mm-hmm. And it was done so poorly that the cable shorted out his laptop.
No. Meaning like killing his laptop?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Breaking it?
Fried it, yeah.
Ooh, ouch.
Because, I mean, USB-C is also spec'd to handle
power.
Charging, like it's not just communication. It's power.
And it's higher wattage power than the standard USB that we currently are using. USB 1 and 2 use a 5-volt power supply, and the current limiting is probably more current limiting, if you will, than what this thing can do. So if you short this incorrectly, you could destroy your whole USB bus. I'm assuming is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible for everybody, except for maybe someone like him, because
well,
he can
just
probably
USB bus, because I mean. When you're talking about power, you're connecting to more than
just
a bus.
If you do it really wrong, yeah, I guess so. Maybe you could reverse voltage or something and fry quite a bit. I'm assuming that he could have fixed his Pixel by opening it up and finding all his power inline.
Well, he could have desoldered stuff.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like it's for most people outside the realm of fixing. For the electrical engineer, probably could fix it, but basically, one bad cord could cost you like $1,500, right? By just plugging it in. So definitely read the reviews.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming if you've got more than one device that has USB 3 and the C connector, and you want to try a new one, try it on the cheaper of the devices, because if you blow it, at least you won't totally destroy it. By the way, are you still dealing with your serialized screen number, serial number?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. All right.
I don't even notice it anymore.
Like, yeah, of course you
really do. I mean, seriously, do you see it?
No, but that's because you don't have white over. You got like a
but
picture
I don't,
background.
That's the whole thing, though. I have a high resolution screen. I now have everything just shifted over. What do I ever see it?
Miles has like 4 inches of space on the left side of the screen. That's just for hiding this fact that he left his serial number sheet inside.
No. It doesn't have to be 4 inches. It's an easy, like, less than 2 inches, an inch and 3/4.
Avoiding using that part of the screen. To find out more about what the heck we're talking about, a couple episodes ago, Brian and Miles and I had a conversation about his laptop screen and replacing it and the joys of that. If you didn't hear that episode, go to geekspeak.org, subscribe to the podcast, and listen to it. It was really funny. One extra funny thing that most people don't know, especially on the radio people don't know, we recorded that conversation 3 times. Actually, we only recorded it once, but we had the conversation 3 times. Then, on air date, it was aired twice. So Miles had that conversation 5 times. So he never wants to hear about that again, and I plan on teasing him every time I see him.
I already hate listening to my voice on the radio.
Really? I like your voice. Hey, let's move on with something else. Let's do some suggestions on what to watch and what to engage with when you have the visual time.
There have been a couple of games out that and I have to say it's really bad for me to talk about a game when I haven't played it myself. But at the same time, some things have caught my attention that I think I may try to take a closer look at, and I think it may be interesting to you,
well,
too.
And this game, there's videos of the game that we're about to talk about, right? Really amazing videos. I watched like 2 of them, and I'm captivated. I want to get it.
Right, and the thing that captivates me, or to
what's the game?
Yeah. It's called Unravel.
Okay.
And one of them is called Unravel. The thing that gets me about these games is I'm so used to these first-person shooters or the quick puzzle game or the racing game. So seeing something that breaks that mold, that is something different, is always exciting to me.
Yeah, I agree.
And because my wife is very into fiber arts, it also caught my attention that it's basically
what
this
is Unravel about? It's EA's new game.
It's a walking
game.
Ball of yarn The ball of yarn is actually not so much a ball as shaped kind of like a cat, a humanoid cat, anthropomorphic cat.
Yeah, make a yarn character, you know, yes. And that's what it is.
And as it walks through its world, it's kind of unraveling. And so you can use that string that it's unraveling itself as to act as a rope or a pulley.
And I recommend going ahead and going to geekspeak.org and today's episode is episode 6 of the 16th season. And the videos there are really interesting. It shows how this character moves. The world is beautiful. I mean, that's the thing that I noticed about it. You're right that it's not a shoot 'em up, right? It's not like it's not a high action. You've got some time to work on this. It's puzzle based, and yeah, it's beautiful, but also kind of touching and sweet. I can see that as well. So you're gonna get this game? Can you get it on Steam? Like, what kind of platforms can you get it on? Because I'm about games. I'm never sure. Like, is it only PS4 or something like that, or can you get it on multiple platforms?
You know, it's funny. I didn't even look that up.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I was just figuring I'd find some way of
find the source. So,
PS4, Xbox, and Windows, which means I'm gonna have to run it on a
emulator.
Well, on a what's the term? Bootcamp. There
boot
we
camp,
go.
Yeah, booting your Macintosh as a Windows machine. Sounds like a horrible thing to do. That game better be awesome. Okay, if you love that game, I'll try it. It's called Unravel, and it's by EA, and it's not a shoot 'em up, and it's an interesting-looking game. If you've got one of the systems we just mentioned, you should give it a shot.
Right, and there's also another one that's actually called That Dragon Cancer.
Oh, that's a game. I put that in the wrong spot on the show.
Yeah, it's a game. It's about mortality. It's about loving and hoping.
Yeah, I read a review of that. It sounds like it's a little hard to watch.
Yes.
It's more like interactive narrative in the sense that it's more about a large story. It's a couple made this game, and they made it after it's a journey of their son or daughter, I can't recall, their child passing away from cancer. And it's an exploration of the experience of going through that. And they created it as it was happening and then finished it after their child had gone.
Yeah, it's
not an uplifting.
It's not.
It is,
but
usually.
At the same time, it could definitely be cathartic. But
absolutely.
It's nice to see a expansion of the genre beyond, like I said, the first person shooter, the racing game. That it's really moving out into this space that really lends itself to saying this is an art form or this is a literary space.
Okay, that is a very important distinction of it, because when you think of video games, we think of our generation, or older, thinks of the arcade games and Pac-Man or something. That's like
the total narrative is that there's inky blinky.
right. And then of course there's the whole era of personal computers, which for you and I kind of represent first person shooters, Quake and the like. And then
there's the Sierra games. Those always had a storyline to them.
Sure. And there's the Diablo games, the kind of like large continual pattern you slowly power up. Very much World of Warcraft has that,
but
similar
still kind of
fashion.
A hack and slash.
A lot of folks ask. And then there's, of course, the puzzle games. And I think the iOS devices have really spun up my interest in puzzle games in some sense. I do play more puzzle games on the iOS devices than I used to. I'm not a big puzzle game lover, but I do like good code. And when I see a good implementation of a puzzle game, I enjoy it. But in any case, That Dragon Cancer is much more a new storytelling. You know, it's a totally different way to tell a story, and it excites me. It's actually kind of what I'm focused on lately for work as well, as the looking at new ways of telling stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in terms of many games, like even the first person shooters, it's how do you put yourself into this position, and it's just like this tired, superficial. I'm in front of a gun and looking down a sight at someone, and there's no real motivation for me to be there other than I got orders.
Right.
To branch out from that and have a greater juxtaposition of the human experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that I think may also be, and I can't say this for sure, but it may be a extension of the fallout from Gamergate and all of that, where you had the whole bunch of people going, no, we want these games for gamers. And a kind of a blowback against that, and people trying to say, wait, well, is there more? Let's try to expand out. Let's try to find something.
Yeah, and I think that games have done this for quite a while, even relatively popular games. You recall the CD-ROM game Myst? Do you recall?
Well, yeah, that started the genre.
That's a similar to this kind of style of experiencing it for experience sake. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was puzzle as well. Mm-hmm. But I agree. I don't agree that it's a side effect of Gamergate. I think it's much more that because games are becoming a more rich and interesting and important part of our lives, like other forms of entertainment become a really interesting and rich part of our lives, they start expanding what they are. And I think that's relatively common for any form of media.
Really? I was actually thinking the last 10 years seemed kind of, for lack of a better word, monochromatic. They're not color. They're very colorful. I shouldn't say that. It's but many
single focused.
Yeah, variations of a theme.
I can think of. I mean, of course, when I was in university, one of the groups that I supported was the games, the mm-hmm. graduate games program. And colleagues of mine, professor friends of mine, are engaged in this completely space about focusing on other forms of game worlds.
Sure.
Right. So a lot of focus on non-linear narrative mm-hmm. explorations. And actually, we've actually had some discussions on the show before. But I then went to a conference about about narrative, interactive narrative stuff, conference at UCSC, mm-hmm. and it was kind of world conference. And sure enough, I go there, and the first two sessions I see are all about like how you get AIs to target characters more effectively. It was all about fighting, right? And I leave, and I'm standing outside in the sun waiting kind of like, what am I going to do? I don't want to go and listen more about how combat systems work in artificial intelligence. I want to know about alternative stories, alternative ways of engaging in content. And so then I have a conversation with a professor. Of course, that's their focus. The money happens to be in the focus, the game, traditional game, shoot 'em up style, right? Because that's where most of the money's being played.
Well, that's what
but
we,
the fringe
that's where
we, has interesting stuff.
That's where we know that the money is. The thing is, that's where it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Absolutely.
If you make movies that are always of that blockbuster type, you're always going to get that result, and you won't see that thing coming. When The Matrix came out, no one really expected it to be as big as it was.
Right. And so there is a lot of independent, interesting games out there. Vib Ribbon was one that I loved on PlayStation. Did I ever show you that game?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Vib Ribbon was a music-based game. But there's a lot of interesting games. Maybe we should have some people on talk about games in the future, because you and I, of course, are not really the best people to talk about it because we don't play a lot of games.
Yeah, we used to.
So what is so this is another thing to go see, but also to hear. And I've actually heard this lecture before. Stephen Hawking speaking about black holes. And Hawking actually one of his very well-known theories is called Hawking radiation. And when he was first going about and explaining to people, he did a lecture about what he actually found. And can you describe what this lecture is and also the quality of it?
The lecture was about the fact that we've always talked about, or in popular culture anyway, black holes being – it sucks everything in and then nothing escapes and – that's it. And maybe there's the stuff that circles it and that becomes a very hot accretion disk. But
anything that goes in doesn't come out.
Right.
So they're cold.
Right.
They're dark. Nothing comes from them. They're black.
Well, I don't know about cold, but yeah, they're
– Well, in the sense they don't radiate anything. Like the traditional idea is that it takes everything in, even light, and therefore, of course, nothing can come out of it. So it's cold. That's just one of the general concepts of it. Right.
And then you have Hawking radiation, which talks about they, for lack of a better term, evaporate over time.
Yeah, and this is what the lecture is about, describing why that process exists. And the cool thing is it's animated.
Right. But it's also talking about the fact that idea is all the matter would be destroyed, all the information that goes in, and that's what's being challenged. It's like, wait, no, it's coming out, and it's coming out. If it goes in a coherent manner, is all of that coherence lost?
Right.
And that's what's being discussed.
This has to do with information theory and whether information could be lost. And theoretically, actually what's going on is the information is spread across the event horizon. And the event horizon actually gets larger. So as the event horizon gets larger, you theoretically have more storage of information space. So it's a really interesting space. Anyway, if you're interested in this kind of topic, go watch this great video. It's Stephen Hawking, Things Can Get Out of a Black Hole. It's an animated thing, and we'll have it up on geekspeak.org. This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle. I'm with Miles, and we'll be right back.
Yeah, the only thing I wanted to add was but just in case anyone happens to be in the vicinity, don't go into a black hole. Your personal information is not going to come out unscathed.
Right. This is GeekSpeak. You can join us online on Facebook or Twitter or I don't know, anywhere we are socially, we're KOSP Geeks, easy way to find us. And of course, if you don't subscribe to the podcast, try that out. You can listen to us anytime you want. Episodes from 2006, even though we were recording even earlier than that, at geekspeak.org. You can also send us comments about questions or comments about the show, geeks at geekspeak.org. Whatever. Okay. Hey, so couple days ago, well, last week, for Valentine's making party. I go to a Valentine's making party for a friend of mine that throws every year. And everyone gets together and makes crafted Valentines for their loved ones. And when I was going, I thought, you know, I haven't done electronics in a while. Let me get my electronics gear. So I grab all my Arduino and electronic parts and stuff. And I go to this house where everybody's cutting up foam core and making, I mean, really amazing things, I have to say. And I just sat in the corner and hacked on Arduino, which is a small microcontroller. You program it very easily through USB. And I had an Ethernet shield and connected it up and basically made a really complicated, cool thing. I'm sure my wife won't listen to the show beforehand. So basically, it's a LED display that reads data from the internet, from my server, and then spits out a message so it can change all the time. And I haven't actually finished packaging it up. But while I was doing that, I realized how much I miss the actual making and creation of electronics. And while I was there, people would come up to the table, mostly kids, and ask, and I'd give them some LEDs and some batteries. I said, just try that out for a while. And they'd play and they'd light it up and I'd be like, cool. And it was an interesting thing. We normally in our society, all of our electronics are wrapped up and sealed up and closed, and we get them and they work until they don't, because you plug in the USB-C bad cable and it fries. Or you're someone like you who actually rips apart your, you know, your screen of your computer and fixes it.
Breaks it and fixes it, yeah.
But most of the time, we're not doing a lot of repair on the stuff in our lives. And I think that that quality is lost. Mm-hmm. Part of that has to do with the complexity. I don't even want to open up my iPhone. It's just too small and tight. But at the same time, as the electronics we have are very hard and aren't designed to be consumer friendly in the modification, there's this giant explosion of things to get that are fun to hack on. You know, $100, you can get a complete electronics investigation kit that can do, I don't know, Bluetooth communication to your phone and upload video files to the internet. Like, mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing.
I think $100, you can do a lot for a lot less than that.
And in fact, the hardware that we have in our lives is structured in such a way, and even more so structured in such a way, that it's kind of illegal for us to tamper with it. Can you tell me about this whole Error 53 from Apple?
This is something people have been coming across when they've been when they have the Touch ID, the little thumbprint scanner.
Yeah, on the iPhones?
Yes.
iPhone 6 and up?
Yeah, 5S and up. Yeah.
Oh, 5S, that's right. Yeah.
Well, sometimes they go bad. As parts do.
Right? Right.
There's nothing that's going to be without flaw. And Apple can sometimes charge a fair, pretty penny to get fixed.
Yeah, like upwards of $200 or more right. to
and
fix that thing.
There has always been a cottage industry of people that will repair Mac laptops and repair iPhones for that matter, and you know, anything, any electronic bits you want to.
I was in the mall recently with the kids and walked by the Apple store, and outside the Apple store were three different vendors that would replace your iPhone screen for, mm-hmm. I don't know, $60 or something like that, like a lot less than what Apple would charge.
Right. Which you can do. The screen actually is doable. The Touch ID, not so much. And
People can get it replaced and fixed from these vendors.
Yes, they do, except that, and it may not happen immediately. This may happen
later.
Days or weeks later.
In fact, to be clear, if you've got an iPhone with a touch finger and you had something other than Apple fix it, don't upgrade it, right? Don't update the operating system?
Well,
it's as bad as that.
It's already there. I mean, if the operating system has been out for a while, we'll do this. The problem is that Touch ID was meant to be a secure mechanism to determine your identity.
Yes.
And it was meant to have it so that it could not be tampered with. So when you have someone who
it's ingenious, I have to say.
Yeah.
Like the way that the whole argument that Apple's making with the US government about encryption is, we want to make this thing so good at protecting the contents on it from privacy, we don't want us to even be able to hack into it and get into it. And mm-hmm. so that's the mechanism they've installed. They have this whole pattern where the thumbprint that you use on that Touch ID can hardware lock stuff into a secure vault. And the only way to unlock that stuff in the secure vault is either wipe it completely and start anew, which you can do with a hardware mm-hmm. reset, or put your thumb on it, and if the thumbprint matches, the hardware will release the or confirm the code that you've entered in. So it's very safe from tampering.
Well, that's the thing, though, is that without having some heroic measures being taken by Apple, you can actually brick your phone.
How so?
Well, that it's not just like, oh, restart it, put the new operating system on there. Like, it actually will stop access to your phone.
Right.
Which also means, just to be clear, any photos or other data that you had on that phone.
Gone.
Gone. Like, you just cannot get to it.
Right.
And if you took it to an Apple store, what they would do is not just replace the part, but they'd rekey the encryption or the encryption key for that to keep it working, something that third-party vendors just don't have access to.
And let's, of course, describe what's going on here on the phone, right? There's a touch surface, and that component has cabling that goes to the encryption vault thing, piece of hard, basically a chip. And then that from there has to connect to the phone. And anywhere in that inside that pattern of that flow of physical hardware, if you tap it or connect into it or look at it, you can start being an intermediary. You can start faking out the operating system. So theoretically, if I took your phone, Miles, that has the thumbprint scanner, opened it up, put myself in a chip between the secure vault and the phone, I could be logging everything that you entered and passing it down back to the secure ID and being in the middle around the entire time. Mm-hmm. So for some way, Apple has to protect that chain by saying, is this healthy chain? Is it secure from a physical perspective? And so what happened was recently, Apple released a patch that did that a little more effectively. The side effect of this is you broke your phone, you took it to a phone repair place, somewhere hopefully cheaper than Apple because it's really expensive. They fixed it, replacing the unit or whatever. You can buy these units, put it all back together. Then the update happens months later from Apple. And
No, not necessarily. I mean, like, it may not happen immediately. That check may not immediately happen.
Oh, no,
that's
it wasn't.
They were funding.
I thought it was a very specific update. It was a very specific update.
Well,
because
anywhere in iOS 9.
I don't think it was all iOS 9. I think they actually fixed this patch. They improved it. But in any case, when the update happens, all of a sudden you get an error message 53. What this means at this point is that the system decided that your Touch ID was not a valid hardware path. And instead of doing anything like, oh, now let's try to save your data, it just bricks the machine. It just totally shuts it down and says, okay, it's dead. And I guess the reason for that is I mean, I don't know why Apple would do this. The claim in the story is that Apple's doing this because they want to make sure to get that repair revenue and not let some other outside vendor. I'm not so pessimistic.
No, I think it really does have to do with you make it so that it can only be updated securely.
Yeah.
And Apple's the only one who can certify that currently. And if you allow for third parties to do that, it means that third parties who are both beneficial and malicious.
Right.
Could potentially have access to it.
It's a hole in the security system.
Yeah, it's very much like that argument with regard to encryption. Do you make something with a backdoor? Because having it be accessible by a third party is the backdoor.
Right. But the long and the short of this is that Apple's making a product that when it gets damaged or you want to fix it or change it or modify it, if they detect that you've done that, they kill the device.
Except
That's the side effect, right?
Except the screen is a different entity. A screen, like, it displays the information or it doesn't. The Touch ID is something that is intimately tied to your credit card, to your bank account.
I'm not claiming it's a bad decision.
So that's
I understand why Apple's doing it. I totally get it. But the side effect also is that there's less ability for individuals to modify and to work on it.
Yeah.
And of course, it restricts who can fix it.
Right. The big issue, though, was that Apple didn't tell anyone that this was happening.
This is the thing that's ridiculous.
That's the thing that that's the thing where they really did drop the ball.
And in fact, what they could have done is the routine that checks this could – I don't know. It's very difficult to do this at this point because what happens is as soon as the phone realizes, oh, there's a security vulnerability, what do you then do, right? Do you take all the data and try to get it off the device and put it somewhere safe? Then you become the owner of this private data. You shouldn't have had access to it in the first place. Theoretically, if the entire system is encrypted, but you can't trust the encryption key that's coming out, you just throw it away.
You should have been backing up either to iCloud or to your local PC. Or
Yeah. And you can then take the phone to them and they will, you know, quote, replace it for the fee that it would have cost originally. Mm-hmm. What they're basically doing is pulling out the electronics that got fried and replacing the board or whatever it was, the component, and that has a high cost.
But if they had notified people about it, those third-party vendors would not have switched it out.
That's right. They would, or at least they would have stopped relatively, you know, sooner than later, right? It's a surprise now. In fact, some third-party vendors might not know it. If you need to get a Touch ID device fixed, do not take it anywhere but Apple.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And if it's, and that's the other thing is sometimes it wasn't even that got repaired.
Yeah.
It was that it wasn't working very well and people just lived with it. And even those people's stuff got broken out. Now, we don't have any numbers from Apple to find out how many people this has been affecting, but it's one of these side effects of, I mean.
But if a class action lawsuit can come about from AntennaGate, you know what's going
to. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because people, I mean, with a $650 phone or, sure. or up,
absolutely.
And up is.
But the priceless data is the thing that's so frustrating to me. If you know, you're not backing, this is another example of not backing up your data. It's
if your
really
data is
bad.
Priceless, you need to make backups. That's
okay, everybody, listen. If you've taken pictures on your phone and right now they get destroyed, the phone's destroyed, are you going to be sad? Solve that problem. You've got to find a backup solution. And it's actually easier than ever to actually do that from a device because I think Google now is offering free uploads of all your pictures on an iOS device mm-hmm. if you have a Google account. And if you, as long as you say it's okay for them to make them smaller, they'll do it an unlimited amount. And then I think this is with video as well.
Yeah, if you have Dropbox has this kind of features. If you have a laptop, you can back up your phone.
You can back up your phone on the laptop. Though, I got to say one thing about backing up from the phone itself in like a backup mm-hmm. this utility where you actually have the full backup. Because of the iCloud syncing and stuff, those backups don't always have everything you think they do, but also you need a device very similar to the one you had to recover that data. So I think of photos as a thing outside of my backup solution of my phone. I pull them off and put them in my own directory structure so that I don't have to think about the software that I'll need to – or the hardware that I'll need to use to reconstitute my system. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I just realized in my head, like, I back up my phones to my laptop. My laptop backs up to my time capsule.
Yeah. You are locked into Apple, baby.
Well, if I didn't have a time capsule, I would have set up something else that used Apple File Protocol and
yeah,
had the same thing.
But still, right now, if you lose your laptop, you have to get another Macintosh to get the stuff off of the time machine.
Which is fine because I have three Macs.
That's fine. So then you get the stuff off the time machine. Now you have to, if you've lost your phone, you have to buy another phone that's similar or better than that phone so you can recover that information. It's a long flow. So pull your images into iPhoto. I use Lightroom, but you know, pull your images into something else so that you at least have them.
Well, something that's newer than the phone, I just thought it was as long as it covers the same OS.
I do a lot of backups and restores of hardware of iOS devices, and you definitely need to move up the chain. You can't do an operating system lower than the one that was restored
right.
to, right?
But I mean the iPhone 5S still supports iOS 9. The
yeah, but if you 9. Have an iOS 6 backup, I don't think you recover that to an iOS 5 device. You can the other
right,
direction.
Right, right, but right. What I'm talking about is the iPhone 5 still does the most recent iOS version. The iOS yes. version is the one that matters, not
it's
the
not
model
just that.
Of the phone.
The hardware also can't go backwards, I don't think. But I'm not sure. I've never tried it. We'll have to give it a shot sometime. okay, so I started this whole conversation about making in our culture of devices becoming harder and harder to work on, if you will. Can you tell me about something creepy in that makerspace? Something a little disturbing?
Well, yeah, cockroaches. Yeah, we don't like them. I mean, you go to a restaurant,
general,
you see them, it's a bad
thing. Yeah.
And when you see them on the road, like if you can get past your revulsion, you step on them. So it's not like we have any real empathy towards them. Or at least I didn't until I saw a do-it-yourself article about how to hack a cockroach. In other words, taking in some probes, digging into the thorax, putting some electrodes into it, and then you can control where the
cockroach
goes because you are basically rewiring its antenna information.
That's really disturbing. So you're saying that like a person can actually do this? There's instructions
yeah.
on how to do
yeah.
this?
Yeah.
You catch a cockroach, you open up its thorax, and you override its system?
Well, you poke into
system.
The thorax, and you also cut down its antenna down to little nubs.
Why does the antenna cause – so if you
– that's how a cockroach perceives the world.
Yeah, but perception of the world does not make movement in the world. Like if I blind you, it's not like I can now control which direction you travel.
But if you replace that blindness with sight, even though it's a false sight, you're going to encourage that you know, to walk.
This is not a like, oh, now the cockroach is fine.
No, it's not. That's the thing is like we're not in general going to say – You know what? What about those poor cockroaches that are being killed in that tented house? We never say that. We never worry about their welfare.
We do mass destructions of entire colonies of cockroaches all the time.
Right. And we don't care whether or not the poison kills them immediately. If they killed them like over the course of 20 minutes.
And within 17 hours, they'll be dead.
Right.
Oh, it's nasty. Right. So what you're saying is that even our society is fine with killing these things. We still get creeped out by the idea of making them cyborgs.
Right. Especially with the fact that we're able to adapt life to be able to serve our whim at such a fundamental level.
And that is whim, baby. There's no use for that. It's not like, yeah, now I can get the take out the trash. It's
haven't you seen the movie The Fifth Element?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a reason for that. Yeah, the little bug that goes around and crawls onto the table.
So wait. How much stuff can a cockroach carry? It's dependent.
Well, things are getting smaller all the time.
So, like, can you put a computer on it or something? What can you do with it?
It's like a transmitter. I don't know.
Like a Bluetooth remote thing?
I don't know. It depends on how big the cockroach is. Have you seen those, like, those hissing cockroaches?
I do not want to cut up a cockroach and modify its body. That's just nasty.
Let's talk about a macabre thing. But the thing about this, though, is that the cockroach, after you've done this modification, will only listen to your commands for a limited period of time.
Until you burn out its synapses? No, or until it goes, this is not correct.
Exactly.
Oh, no way.
They actually correct for that and go like, okay, I'm just going to go my own way now. They stop listening to your inputs.
So it's not actually damaging. They're actually learning. So that's very similar to if I removed your sight and put on a VR headset for you and tried to drive you around. Eventually, I'd bump you into something, and eventually you'd be like, I don't think I really see what I think I see. And you start paying attention to the senses.
And then I'd just basically be blind.
With pretty pictures. That's pretty macabre. I don't know why I feel like it's so macabre. I think that's really interesting because I think you're right that I don't think much about the destruction of cockroaches.
That's the thing, though, is – right now with cockroaches, I'm sure our audience is now split, going like, they're cockroaches. Who cares? And there are other people going like, oh, that's really ick factor, creepy. Because what is your comfort level? The people who are okay with it, is it okay when you get to spiders? Is it okay when you get to mice?
How about guinea pigs? See, I think mice versus guinea pig is a good line there. Because guinea pigs are cute, and you pick them up, they go, wah, 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 you know?
And is your cutoff going to be, does the thing feel pain? And then what is the
perception? What is pain?
Yeah. And then you get in the whole, like, what's the consciousness? What's the nervous system? And, like, is it okay to do to, I don't know, to roundworms?
I don't know.
Or to flatworms?
Well, roundworms don't have antennae. I mean...
They have sensor information. Like, I'm talking about in the future. Like,
you know, most of the time I stay really optimistic and happy on the show because we're talking about tech. It's like, oh, this is cool. Well, we'll have a problem here, but we'll solve it eventually. Humankind's great. And then you get to this kind of stuff. You're like, I don't know.
But these questions that I'm bringing up are things that I think we do need to talk about before they happen.
Well, they're already happening.
Well, no, we're talking about cockroaches now. What about when we get to
mammals?
You can do a do-it-yourself, you know, dog, like your dog.
Want a dog that performs better? Small surgery and an Arduino board does the trick.
What are the ethics of if your dog has died and then you can stick probes into your dead dog's brain and
this
start
is so dark, dude.
I know it is, but before it was just a thought experiment and it was uncomfortable, we could just stop talking about it. But what happens if it's the technology makes it a reality? Where do you stand? Because it'll be a reality.
Yeah, okay. It's a very interesting question because you do need to – at some point, this stuff becomes more and more emergent, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's similar to our privacy thoughts and security thoughts, right? Because the world changes, the technology changes, and now it really is $30 and a Xacto blade away from any being able to do this, right?
So remote
control a cockroach with your phone. You can do that now. That's easy.
Mm-hmm.
Just go online and buy an Arduino Bluetooth controller device, right? And boom. Yeah, you're right. We have to figure out where our comfort zone is about these things and also where our laws should be about these things. Very cool. Hey, you're listening to Geek Speak. In a moment, we're going to talk more
about... Still.
A few of you are listening. Most of you have left. We miss them. Hopefully,
Sorry.
They're not going to do surgery on a cockroach.
We're going to do better stuff later.
We'll get some space news in a minute. We'll talk a little bit about the right to repair stuff and some social network updates. Stick with us here on Geek Speak. This is Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell, and I'm speaking with Mr. Miles Elam. Hey.
Hey.
We got a little macabre there. with cockroach modifications, electronics.
Yeah, so let's just go back to like iPhones when they're broken.
Okay, so there's a whole movement, an advocacy group talking about the right to repair stuff. And this definitely in our society, when you see companies business interests being not to make things repairable, because of course if your iPhone breaks completely, you have to buy a new one. That's actually good from the company that's selling them.
Yeah, and we talked about this with cars. Like it used to be your car had a carburetor. It had a, you know, the repair your own car was not unusual. And now with more electronic systems and those systems being put under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and being protected as a secret, even though it's your car?
Yeah. So yeah. Last summer, the Copyright Office asked a group wanted a group to defend the right for video game console jailbreakers to mod or repair their systems. And the reason, of course, for this is as we progress, there's all this digital art, old video games, mm-hmm. that it makes a lot of sense for us to keep it in our culture. But the hardware for them and the software and the systems for them have degraded. But there's copyright around these things. So you can't just copy them and reuse them. Well, you can, but it's technically kind of illegal. Mm-hmm. So there's this whole question in the courts about how do you allow people to take obscure copyrighted content and pull it back into the digital age and keep on updating it.
Yeah. What happens if you have a whole bunch of old Atari 2600 cartridges?
Perfect example.
And you want to play the games.
And theoretically, you have the license for them because right. You have the hardware.
But you just can't find any players anymore.
So this is all about the maker movement in a lot of sense. So anyways, the court made this request and there was nobody around with a prepared legal argument for this. And so that kind of spawned this idea that we really should have a structured way of thinking about the ability for us to work on, modify, repair our culture and protect that in law. So repair groups from around the world have formed a new coalition. And it's a lobbying advocate group that will focus on reforming the Digital Millennium Copyright Act first to preserve the right of repair. Because the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, you've probably heard on the show before, basically says if there's some way the company has made to protect the data inside a system, if you hack into it, you're to figure it out, you are breaking the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. You're doing a legal thing. And therefore, you can't figure out how things work. That's the side effect of this.
Yeah. And this has come across with people wanting to jailbreak their phone, saying, I bought my phone. I want to do other things. And I understand it's not going to be under warranty before because I'm doing stuff that it's not meant to do.
Right.
But that right to do so has been going back and forth. Sometimes it's legal, sometimes it's considered illegal, sometimes it's considered legal to jailbreak but not make jailbreak software.
Yeah, it's really like weird space.
Yeah.
So we have an advocacy group. It's repair.org, moving the repair industry forward. Here's a little bit of their mission statement on the site. Over 3 million Americans work hard every day to keep our cars, computers, appliances, and critical infrastructure operating smoothly. Repair is the lifeblood of local economies. Our members make products last longer, save owners money, and create local jobs. So it talks about the competitive repair market is vital to the economy. It talks about how many people want to be doing repair, how if you make an economy of being able to repair things, you lower the costs of everything and you infuse more money into the system at a non-corporate level but at a individual level, which I think personally is kind of interesting. I don't think Apple really needs more cash. So if you're interested in that, repair.org is where you can learn more about it and potentially donate some dues or learn about some legal support you might be able to get. Okay. We haven't done space news in a while. Mr. Miles Elam, let's talk about space.
SpaceX going to try for a fourth time to land in the sea.
On a barge?
Yes, on a barge without – the last time they tried it, they got really close. They stuck the landing, but one of the landing struts didn't lock into place, and so then it fell over.
Fell over, right.
But they actually – I mean, in terms of – it was closer than they ever been before, and by all rights, they got the hard part done – but one piece of the pie just, fell by the wayside. Well, turns out that landing back again in Florida after their next launch will not be amenable to where they're at. I mean, mm-hmm. their orbit, where it's going to be sending the payload, going back all the way to land isn't going to work. So they're basically stuck with doing a barge again, and it'll be a nice opportunity for them to try again. Hopefully they can.
Cool. And so February 24th is the next launch attempt. And if you want to take a look at it live, that's when you want to pay attention, February 24th. All right. Let's talk about some social news. And this is actually kind of – I found fascinating. I saw this spin through. I thought we might have covered it on GeekSpeak, but maybe we didn't. And that is the ruling in India about Facebook's free internet service and kind of denying it. Can you tell me a little bit about this?
The idea is that you purchase a phone that comes with Facebook.
Right. And Facebook subsidized the phone, and you get free access to Facebook and to some other services that Facebook controls.
It's not
controls.
Metered. Like you, yeah, you get...
Is this internet.org, that movement?
Internet.org?
Isn't
that's,
it?
That's the...
What's the Facebook thing? I thought it was internet.org.
But sorry,
go on. Tell me more of the story.
Well, the thing behind that, and this is actually true when you look at polls from India, many people think of Facebook as being the internet.
Yeah.
Far more so than other parts of the
– Oh, it is.
Like, for example, in the U.S. Yeah. A lot of people will go like, yeah, Facebook's what I go on the internet, but there's a lot of other things like email, stuff like that. For people who have these phones, a lot of them, Facebook is synonymous with the internet. And that's one of the things that people were worried about with regard to net neutrality mm-hmm. is are you just going to be consuming from a particular corporation or a group of corporations and not have access to outside materials?
This basically hardens the world – it hardens the internet into multiple power groups.
Into multiple fiefdoms, yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, internet.org is by Facebook.
Okay.
Internet.org is for Facebook, and they're – Here, I'll read a little blurb from their site. It's a very pretty, glossy site. The internet is essential to growing the knowledge we have and sharing it with each other. And for many of us, it's a huge part of our everyday lives. But most of the world does not have access to the internet. Internet.org is a Facebook-led initiative with the goal of bringing internet access and the benefits of connectivity to the two-thirds of the world that doesn't have them.
Yeah.
So now, that seems like a really good mission.
Yes. Now, to be clear... There is this flip side of the people here who think of Facebook as being synonymous with the internet would not have any access by and large. This is who that target audience
That's
is
right.
to make it so cheap that they can get even some access. Is some access better than no access? And that's really what Facebook was going for. Some access is better. But India has ruled that net neutrality is the law of the land and it will actually affect the Facebook app.
That's right. And the one we're talking about here is the internet.org by Facebook's initiative called Free Basics. So it provides people with access to useful services on their mobile phones in markets where the internet access may be less affordable. And the sites – and that the issue that India had was that the sites that you can access are controlled by this consortium. Though in general, I don't – there's nothing negative here. It's just the idea – I mean I don't want to come across as saying, ooh, this is nasty and creepy, because I don't think it is. I think the intention of Facebook is really intelligent, right? This is – internet's amazing service. The more people have access to it, the better people's lives will be. How do we make it more accessible to more people? Well, we have to subsidize that somehow. How do we pay for that?
But also, how do we grow our audience? Because Facebook has how many billion people on it already? The only way for them to grow their business now is to expand to more people. So it's not altruistic, but at the same time – capitalism rarely is, but still can be a force for progress.
Right. You can also – I mean the other thing is that there's kind of an – there's an Facebook's welcoming other sites to join them in this endeavor. And you know the places that they're actually covering right now is all over Africa, all over Asia Pacific, quite a bit in Latin America. And so the service is around and people are using it, and if – the people didn't have that service, they wouldn't have these free basic services, right? So there's a benefit to it. Mm-hmm. Do you think that India is making the right choice here, Miles?
There is no right choice. There's always going to be someone who is left behind because of any decision that is made
in some
way or another. And I think that does need to be clear. Like Facebook is not evil here, and I don't believe the Indian government is either. And so when in that light, like, do I think they're right? I don't know. There's no right answer.
Let's describe this.
But I think the push for net neutrality is a good one.
Yeah.
Because without that push, I don't know that Facebook would be trying to find so many partners to get to join them in the initiative.
Right.
If there was no push from various countries to have net neutrality, would Facebook have any incentive whatsoever to open their garden, or for that matter, not charge exorbitant fees for partners to come in to their
well,
garden?
Well, okay, and I don't know what kind of fees. I didn't research what kind of fees they're doing. It might be that you participate by sharing resources, like mm-hmm. you or offer services. I'm assuming that all these people have access to Wikipedia, for example. I don't think Facebook would block that. I think that makes sense. And I doubt the Wikimedia organization is going to actually pay any fees for that. Mm-hmm. They keep the servers up and running, and it's an amazing service to society, having a global growing encyclopedia. So I think that's a serious benefit. I'd love it if everyone on the planet had access to
that
service.
But there may be caching and licensing rules that apply to it. Like, for example, Wikipedia, the licensing is very clear on how you can use it. And so it wouldn't be very difficult for Facebook to be able to look at that licensing and go, oh, hey, and if we have a problem, we can always just set up some proxy servers to go from Wikipedia.
Right.
Individual websites, most of the time they don't have a license. So unless they get a specific agreement to say, yes, you can retransmit this data and send it through Facebook servers in a proxy, like in a caching setting,
right,
where they can manipulate it and maybe massage it so that it takes up less bandwidth.
And there's other benefits to limiting the resources available through this internet service, this free basic service, from a Facebook perspective. If they're implementing networks in hard to reach places by putting up weather balloons or running new cables or doing line of sight, you know, microwave, there's a lot of infrastructure to be put in place to make this available. That's why those areas don't have it already, because the infrastructure is not there. So mm-hmm. Facebook's bringing that in with their money behind it and finding ways of paying for it. And I totally get that has to be paid for. And if you then take that network that is at whatever level it is and say, actually, anybody that has access to the entire internet, pretty soon people potentially would be starting to stream videos, right? And if they're streaming videos, they're taking up a lot of that bandwidth. And if the bandwidth is already kind of impaired because they're spreading it thin, that's kind of not the target for Facebook, right? So therefore, video services would be difficult to service.
There you get into the T-Mobile and Verizon's, where they have, here's some video that we've found acceptable, and it's usually because it's at a certain bit rate or whatnot. And if you just say, if you make it clear that this is at a particular bit rate and send a certain set of headers, or we'll send it on through, that would satisfy most cases for net neutrality. But that hasn't been the case always.
And to be clear, I'm sure Facebook will be having their video services working fine in these areas because, of course, they're going to bring their hardware close to the access points.
It depends. Some of these phones that are going out there are not what we would consider a high-end smartphone.
Not a smartphone,
They may be
general access.
That is just general access. Yeah.
So it's great. It's clearly a service that will benefit a lot of people, and it breaks this idea of net neutrality. And you know, we've been talking a lot about the benefits of this, and so I think right now it's very hard to remember what the negative is. So the net neutrality negative in a large sense is, if you allow monopolies to form, if you allow structures to form in the internet where there's a severe dominance and then people are dissuaded or stopped from accessing other resources, those dominant players will stay forever. Right. If you couldn't have new newspapers be formed in the United States and have distribution when newspapers were the thing, if that was illegal or was hard to do, to use distribution, like the mail service just didn't deliver mail newspapers unless it was these five top newspapers, you could see the downside of that. Those top newspapers are the only ones that provide all the news to the United States, and you really get a problem there. But we've always had the ability for anybody to start up a news company, right? So therefore, because of that, even though distribution has been expensive, there's been competition in the area.
Or if you get stuff like, you can only look at New York Times on an iPhone, and you can only get the Wall Street Journal on a Nexus Android,
right?
You know, like that type of thing.
You get some society separation that you don't really want. But I guess what I'm saying is the distribution system of newspapers were very expensive. Internet's mm-hmm. not expensive. But if you then put in the blocks with net neutrality not being in effect, you theoretically can get other companies not being able to start.
Then distribution does become expensive.
And then distribution becomes expensive, and that's actually kind of the problem. All right, cool. Cool story. I don't know where I stand. I like they're doing it. I think it's good that people are getting access, and I think it's fascinating that India said, nope, not for us. One more thing about Facebook. New study about students?
Yes, it turns out that people who are overtired, parents, are more prone to checking Facebook more often and, you know, other cranky behavior when you're on Facebook. Habitual, just like checking.
The more you're tired, the more likely you are to do
these things that
Facebook stuff.
Well, the more you're tired, the more you are. Usually, you're going to be more stressed out too. You're going to be like, "Am I missing something?" And because your brain gets fuzzy when you're tired, and so you look at these things like, "What else? What else is going on? What's going on?" And that, of course, makes you more tired and gives you less time to get stuff done that you want to get done, and then you spend more time on Facebook, and the cycle continues. So there actually is a correlation here, and someone should be aware of it. So if you are feeling overtired or, you know, a little testy or cranky, take a break from social media.
Yeah, because actually if you don't, you won't get the sleep you need, which is kind of opposite of what you actually need when you're sleepy.
Right. And also, if you're looking at a bright screen when it's the middle of the night, it really messes up your sleep regulation patterns.
That's what I hear. So the study is from the University of California, Irvine, and it showed a direct correlation between chronic fatigue, crankiness, and Facebook browsing, which I think is wonderful that the crankiness was stuck in there too. I wonder which is the correlation. You're tired, you get cranky, or you're tired, you go on Facebook, you get cranky. Or you're cranky and you're tired, and so you want to go on Facebook. Like, it's very hard to know how the correlation works there. Press release was last week, and the study had 17
and you see Bernie Trump.
1,788 adults aged 19 to 32. So stay off social media when you're tired. I think I'm saying this repeatedly because guess who has a problem with this? Moi. That's when I do it. This story is not news at all, but please tell me why we have it in the feed. AT&T is the villain. I mean, that's like a standard trope here on GeekSpeak.
And you would think it's also this weird partisan issue. Like, we've talked about the FCC and saying the Republicans have been against net neutrality and sure, the Democrats have been for. Well, in this case, the Republican lawmaker in Tennessee is saying AT&T is the villain here. We want to have municipal internet.
And AT&T
it's
stopping.
The entrenched ones, the AT&Ts, the Comcast, the Verizons are stopping us from going this way, that if a municipality wants to bring in a municipal level of internet, they should not have it blocked by these private carriers who are not servicing
– who won't service them anyway.
Who won't service them anyway, or don't provide them a service that many citizens consider adequate.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes the local municipalities' new internet providing might be the only competitor for an internet provider in that right. area.
So if you look back in the archives, you've seen many cases where the municipality will say, hey, AT&T, come to us. And no, you guys don't seem like having a good
worth
market.
It.
Verizon, come to us. It doesn't look like it. Cox, Comcast, Time Warner, it doesn't look like it's worth it. Okay, we're going to set up our own. And just before they turn the lights on, they've laid all the fiber. Wait, you can't do that. That's unfair government competition.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence, who's used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so use our stuff any way you'd like it. Just let them know that Geek said hi. This is Independent Public Radio, 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz, streaming live worldwide at kosp.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, or to subscribe to our podcast, go to geekspeak.org. You can reach us on Twitter. We're KOSP Geeks. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me today was Mr. Miles Elam. Miles, thanks so much for doing the show with me. It was a pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
You can chat with us and ask us more questions online at our website, geekspeak.org. Email us, geeks@geekspeak.org. And we do answer those things, so please do feel so to do so. Our show is in great thanks, produced with help from our intern Chandler, our Canadian correspondent Greg Merkley, and our musician Michael Newman of Pet Star Music for our theme song. Thank you all for helping us with this episode 6 of our 16th season. Did you want to do a little bonus thing at the end, or are you just saying that you wanted to wrap up that creepy cockroach story with something? That's why you were talking about it earlier at the break?
I wanted to talk about the right to repair your own stuff.
Yeah,
I thought
crucial.
That was important to bring up, at least to talk about it.
Yeah.
I thought it was more important than some of the other stories that we had.
Yeah. I'm glad we covered it. I'd intended to drag
it
into the second
part. It didn't make any sense to have it after every – like we were still on the topic of
I think that the long-form story in the middle of the show can go into the third part of the show and keep going, really.
Sure.
There's no reason not to.
Yeah. But, the news that we didn't get to, which still be up on the website.
Yeah. You want to go through them real quick?
Yeah. Google is blocking websites that show fake download buttons. I'm sure you've done that if you've ever tried to download some software.
I love that.
The big green download, and it's actually not that button you should be hitting because that's an ad. It's the small blue link just below it that's download or just above
yes.
it. You press it the first time, you realize like, what is this? This is antivirus software. I was looking for this, you know.
Re-encoding video file or something.
Yeah. Right.
Windows 10 passes the 10% market share, overtakes Windows 8 finally.
And Windows XP,
right,
finally.
Right. And that's the thing is the way Windows has been doing their upgrades over the years is that because they don't force auto-update or have it in the past, you've got this giant install base of XP still. You have this giant install base of 8.1, And it's
well, you also have all the people with old computers that are still running XP. Yeah.
And they can't upgrade to 10, right?
Well, why would you? If your computer, to your mind, is working just fine, why would you spend $100?
That's what it costs.
To get a new Windows license that may break stuff.
Yeah, it won't work as well on your old hardware, really.
Well, I don't know. Maybe it would. Maybe it wouldn't. You don't know.
You just don't know. Another other Windows story too, right?
Yeah, and this one is that Microsoft is making Windows 10 a recommended update for.
What's the difference between? What do you mean? What is that
for Windows 7 and Windows 8 users? Now, if you have Windows 7, Windows 8, Windows 10 is a free upgrade.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's a recommended update, that means that it can download and start installing on it automatically.
Yeah, they keep on doing this. They really want people to upgrade, and so they're being as strong as possible to upgrade. I kind of think you should. I mean, because they're going to support Windows 10 better than the other ones, and Windows 10 was going to be a evergreen operating system, right? They're always going to patch
it. But someone may have to leave their computer on, come and in the next morning, and it's updated. And
I think it's going to be harder and harder for people to not be updated from Windows 7 or Windows 8 because of this. So what you're saying is that
nagging
normally,
someone is a different thing.
Yeah, normally
– to actually do it – automatically,
I guess what you're describing is that the auto updates on Windows or updates in general on Windows are come in different categories.
Yes.
Absolute, which is neat, is only exists in Windows 10. Then Recommend, which exists in 7 and 8, which basically normally you have it set up to just auto download Recommend, and then Others. And Others are different optional stuff you don't necessarily need. You know, maybe there's an update to a font you're not using or something. Like there's stuff that they're going to offer to you. You don't always have to get it. And then there's the recommended is basically like do it. And so if you're security conscious and kind of a good general user, you just click the I'm going to accept things that are recommended and you get basically patch.
Mm-hmm.
They rolled in a complete operating system update in that same methodology, which is kind of breaking the contract of what recommended actually means.
Right. Which is then going to have people go like, well, I don't want to update. And they're going to turn off Windows Update and suddenly you're going to have a whole bunch of unpatched
secondary
systems.
Problem. Ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the side effect of doing these kind of things. You lose people's trust. Not good. Yeah. Well, there's a couple more, but I think we could wrap it up too. You want to cover them?
Yeah, I'll just do a quick thing. Normally when meteorites fall.
Yeah, you hear about them or you see them on video.
Yeah, you hear them. And I've seen photos before of like a meteorite that's fallen through into a car. I've seen ones that have fallen to someone's house.
Yeah, okay.
But never in the modern era, in other words, modern record keeping was kept, has there ever been a meteorite strike that has killed someone?
A direct fatality?
Yes.
Even with that one that happened in Russia where there's a whole bunch of meteorites that exploded in the atmosphere, we saw the videos
of
those.
That was Tunguska.
No one died in that?
No one really lived in the area.
No, not that. I'm talking about a more recent thing. There was a lot of video on YouTube because people have dash cams.
No one died from that.
No one died from that. Okay.
There may have been some injuries, maybe some broken glass, but no one
died.
There were no fatalities.
So there was a fatality from a meteorite.
Yes.
And this means that somebody got hit by one or got close enough?
At an engineering school. Yes, someone got hit by it and three others were injured.
Whoa. And someone passed away.
Yes.
Died.
Someone was killed by a meteorite.
Wow. And that hasn't happened in recorded history that we know.
Correct.
Wow,
first time in modern history.
I mean, that's horrible.
Like people have talked about it in antiquity. Like that's kind of like goes on with this whole, the god struck them down.
Right.
And who knows what's true.
You think being hit by lightning is rare. Right. Meteorite strike is very rare.
Right.
Wow. All right, one more. Let's talk.
I mean, it's rare enough to see a meteorite fall.
Yeah.
Like, it's rare enough to see a satellite fall.
Yeah.
To be one of the people who watches that. And that's one of the things we have up there, and they come down on a regular basis.
It's a big planet, man.
Yeah.
Not a lot of people want to compare to the
planet. 7/10 of it is water.
Yeah. So, Siri, the phone service, the personal
for
assistant
iPhones, yeah.
phone. And then there's Amazon has the Echo mm-hmm. unit that actually you're talking to.
I forgot the name of it. Yeah.
I can't remember either. Somebody's.
It was covered in a Super Bowl ad.
Yeah, I bet it was. I'm actually really interested in it. I kind of want to get one. I've decided that it'd be fun to have a digital assistant in the house, so I'll probably get one. But there's also Microsoft's one, which is called Cortana.
Yeah.
Cortana. You tell me about the story about Cortana?
It's funny. They're programming Cortana to not accept or put up with sexual harassment, that the conversation that it has with you, as much as it has conversations with you, will not put it in a subservient standpoint. Like
does it have a female persona or does it have a non-gender persona? It has all the pictures I've seen is a digital female face.
I believe it is a female persona. But
yeah.
At the same time, it's
but the voice is
people have
feminine.
like, for example, with Siri and others, people have asked outrageous questions, and there have been canned answers for them for some of these outrageous questions.
Yeah, I mean, they're called like Easter eggs to some degree, right? Mm-hmm. You can ask funny questions like, "What, you know, what is 42?" And it'll answer. Like, these things normally have pre-programmed stuff. And this is kind of the level of engagement that we basically have, is a lot of canned pre, you know,
right.
Natural language is actually really hard. But Cortana specifically, the designers are saying, we don't want this thing to act in a subservient way to the user.
Right. Don't want it to be just acceptable. And they're not doing it as it's going to be confrontational. It's simply not going to play along. It's going to diffuse it and be like, yeah, not.
But isn't what you want from a digital assistant different depending on the type of person you are? I mean, no one – if you program the thing to be subservient and almost fearful of the user, you know, in the reaction, it seems like they'd be – and it's all fictitious, of course. What's wrong with that in some sense? There's nobody suffering.
That's the open question. And that's the thing that says, like, is it okay that you call Siri a female dog? Is it okay to, you know, talk about whether it'd be okay
what you want to do sexually with them or something?
Would yeah. like to copulate with a donkey.
Like, right. Like, there's a whole type of engagement and conversation that people do have. And when you're talking to a digital assistant, you could talk in that personally and privately. It's kind of akin to a therapist relationship. It could be. Like, there's a lot of types of relationships we don't normally engage with, don't think about. But these companies are codifying the kind of relationship this thing will have with you, even though it's not a real thing. Like, it's not a real person. It still can affect the way you engage with it. And then theoretically, the way you engage with other people, right? I mean, if it slowly corrects your grammar or slowly does not respond to conversational tone that you normally do in your workplace, you might actually change the way you speak in your everyday life. So I can see the benefit of not engaging in some types of conversation.
That makes it not a subservient, that becomes a partner.
Yeah, but what right does a software company like Microsoft have to alter the way we communicate?
Well, one, they're a for-profit company, and you can choose not to buy their product if you don't like it.
Sure.
And when they do this, if it takes off and, you know, Apple follows suit with Siri or becomes a norm, it wouldn't surprise me that there'd be some niche out there where someone's making a
– alternate version that is subservient.
BDSM yeah, sure. submissive.
You'll know there'll be a niche. We really should start. Who knows? You know, Miles, we really should start up a company. That sounds like an awesome idea.
you have fun with that.
Okay. It's interesting because, you know, the laws of robotics, that kind of rule, right? Or the idea that, you know, the horrible idea of 2001 where a computer gets really evil and just decides to do something that it is programmed to do and it kills people. Those ideas are dramatic and crazy, and we've talked about them for a long time. But they're not as nuanced as this. This is much more interesting.
But I want to stop you with that because a lot of the stories from Asimov when he's talking about the three laws of robotics really deals with the morality of the people with regard to the robots.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Not with the morality of the robots themselves.
Oh, absolutely.
So
it's a reflection on how society acts to these things. So this is right in that line. But I guess what I'm saying is that the thought about how our society is going to change with artificial intelligence and how – and even how – what kind of relationships we'll have with artificial intelligence, yeah, you're right. It says a lot about us. It's very fast.
So does that put Microsoft in the role of they – as moral entities, to try to be a moral entity.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Should they be obligated to do this?
But the reason why a subservient relationship potentially is unethical or immoral is because the person is suffering. If it's a digital assistant, nobody's suffering. It's an artifice.
That's the questions with Asimov's stories with robotics and the laws of robotics. Do they actually suffer?
Okay, but that's a different question. I'm saying, like, at the current level, what we have right now at the artificial level, we don't increase artificial intelligence. We just keep it at that level. It's much stupider than a cockroach. Mm-hmm. And you have that artificial intelligence kind of engagement. Mm-hmm. And you structure it so it's completely subservient and submissive and scared and qualities of you know, empowering, whatever that relationship
is.
Yeah. If you make that relationship, no one is currently suffering in that situation except for maybe the impedance of a person to grow away from that behavior because of the subservient one is not in any – it's an artificial. It's an artificial thing.
But that comes the question of, is the user moral to keep doing that?
And like, is Microsoft – if they make the software
that
does that –
is it about the morality of the company? Is it about the morality of the – assistant, or is it about the morality of the users of that assistant?
Or is it about the – and is it about the morality of the corporation that makes this product that allows a person to act in such a way that is wouldn't be acceptable if it was a real creature. Like, what about this aspect? We are going to change in the way we interact with things, right? We say thank you to – some people say thank you to Siri. I do not say thank you to Siri because I know it's a software program and it doesn't make any sense to say thank you to Siri. But at the same time, if my normal language comes to a place where I just expect something from something and then that impedes that influences my communication with any other people at all, which of course it will. I'm a social being. Then my reaction with Siri does affect how I interact with other people, right? Wouldn't it?
I don't know. Well, that's a question for social scientists.
Well, it's a question we're going to run into. We're going to start seeing this more and more. Absolutely. I think that was a more interesting bit than talked about the hardware stuff in the middle of the show. Too bad it's only for the podcast.
Well, hey, at the same time, just to wrap up,
yeah,
I do think about these philosophical questions that we get into.
Sure.
And we do talk about philosophy a little bit when we're talking about making and what do you own and stuff like that. But also this thing about the personal system, what is moral and what is not. And I do hear from listeners from time to time. Over the years, we've heard people say, like, can you just stay out of the philosophy and just stick with the tech? And part of the tech feels to me like if you're not having a conversation about ethics –
what are you talking about?
Yeah, what's the point?
Who cares?
Yeah. Like, is the tech for its own sake or is it to serve people? And if it's serving people, don't you have to worry about the ethics of it, the ramifications of it?
Yeah. You know, this idea – I understand you want to wrap up. That sounds great. Do you have to go anywhere?
No.
Okay. So the other aspect of this that I think is interesting, another part of this that I think is really interesting has to do with we have some people's sexual desires or sexual orientations go into a space that we are very uncomfortable with because there's potential for suffering. Bestiality is a perfect example of this, and pedophilia, right? These are qualities that a human being can enjoy and something else suffers, right? If you virtualize that something, if you make animated, you know, cartoons of those things.
Or even photorealistic because they're computer generated.
No, yeah. Computer generated, completely photorealistic. And then you give a Siri type personality to something. There is a really dark, creepy space that emerges for people that don't find that tasteful. But no one's actually suffering in this situation, which is normally what you
justify. But it's also from an evolutionary basis. Then you have to get into the question of we are pre-programmed to relate to other human beings a certain way.
Yes.
And we deviate from that in certain limited ways, but there are fundamental interactions that human beings have with one another that is molded and shaped by culture, but has biology underlying it.
Okay. I get that. But at the same time, let me ask you this question. You have you're attracted to females, right?
Yes.
Okay. If you were told by your society that your attraction to females was deviant and horrible and you should suppress that in any way possible, and in fact you should actually get chemically castrated if you can't stop that behavior, how do you survive in that experience? You become
– I become like Alan Turing, only less brilliant.
No offense to you, Miles. You're awesome. A lot less brilliant.
Yeah.
No, you're actually a really smart man. I don't know how smart he was, but anyway, we're talking about Turing. Yeah. Okay. All right. We're idiots. We should stop talking about it. So, yeah, exactly. He went through that experience, right, because he was homosexual and was completely subjugated and finally committed suicide based off of that suppression. Well, there are people in our society –
after chemical castration, yeah.
There are people in society like that. Pedophilia, people that are attracted to children and people that are attracted to animals. And I'm sure there's others that are potentially – but that's the example case of like – quote, yeah, evil, if you will.
And this is why I talked about this. This is the realm of social scientists.
Yes.
Where you have to find out and this is just like a recent study. It was talking about what happens to all those people who played violent video games.
Yeah.
And it turns out all of us who played violent video games were fine. People who were violent to begin with and then also were drawn to violent video games.
Right.
Yeah. The violent person
– They don't seem to correlate.
Was already violent.
Most cases don't see correlation.
And well, the violence may have been enhanced. Who knows?
So I guess the question I have is you could with artificial intelligence, with highly rendered, with dolls, with robotics, you could completely serve the needs of those types of people without any human being suffering. There's no – just
or any living thing.
Any living thing suffering. So then does it – is it still something that we want to stop and something that we don't want to be in a society where people are doing that? We still want to stop them from that? Because the normal justification for saying, no, you cannot do that is that someone or some animal suffers.
Right.
But when you remove that, it becomes a very different space. That's another place right. where I think artificial intelligence, robotics, that kind of idea of social engagement with artifice becomes really interesting. And I don't know
why,
the answer
to these. This is why the social scientists need to step up and talk about if someone relates to a non-human, someone, a pre-programmed non-sentient
sure.
that may have aspects of sentience, I guess is the best way to describe it.
Hard to say, ask Turing.
And do they exhibit antisocial behavior as a result of that or to the contrary? Like, for example, many people who play violent video games end up being more mellow
mm-hmm.
and less violent it's because of that.
And so, do you know who the best researchers in sociology, where they are right now?
Where
the ones that have the most power? Facebook. Facebook has the ability
oh, yes.
to do massive social tests on millions of people anytime they want. And we all say yes to this. And it's an amazingly powerful thing. And the growth rate of understanding human interaction is there.
Yeah, it's great.
Facebook is really on it. So they'll have an artificial intelligence as well, and they'll make decisions on what they want to do to the human race at some level. I mean, the
Facebook has put limits on it. Like, for example, their absolutely. Online stores, they don't want people advertising for guns. So they're yeah. making limits on that. So who knows how, you know, will they say your kink is not okay?
Right. and also, they could potentially find out if it's okay to say a kink is not okay. Or if it's, you know, like this idea that maybe – I mean, the inspection, like you're saying, we need social scientists to step up and figure this out. Well, they're going to figure this. Like, they're the place that's going to figure this out.
And so. Then is society going to step up and listen to them? That's the next step that has to come with that.
Well, if they've got good the academia will listen to them if they've got good studies. All the studies they've done so far are rigorous, right, that they're releasing. Of course, they're doing a lot more that they're not releasing. But I don't know. I just think we're living in a really interesting space, definitely. Well, I think we should wrap it up.
Yep.
All right.
Thanks, everyone, for listening in.
Yeah, you like this kind of stuff, this extra bonus material? Do let us know, because, of course, with the way podcasts work, all we know is they got downloaded. We don't know how many people listen to them. So if you're interested in this kind of topic, best thing you can do is go up in iTunes and recommend it, pass it around to people. We'd love to grow our audience. And, of course, we do this for free, and we don't put any marketing dollars into it. We've been doing it. How long have we been doing this, Miles? 16 years.
15 and a half.
15 and a half years.
Yeah.
Wow. It's a long time. All right. See you next week.
See you.